Hello, this is Ukraine Calling, a weekly roundup of what's happening in Ukraine, with a focus on a main story. I'm Bohdan Nahailo, currently with Democracy Reporting International in Ukraine, standing in at Hromadske Radio in Kyiv, and here are some of the main stories from Ukraine.
The tragedy of the Babi Yar is a wake-up for the whole humanity.
You haven't actually answered my question, yes, though, Mr. Peskov. I just want to know whether you accept the findings that we have just seen, which say that the missile which brought down the plane came from a Buk missile launcher, which was from Russia, and which then returned to Russia. Do you accept it?
There is nothing to accept or to deny. First of all, I repeat, these are preliminary statements.
J.K. Rowling has revealed that the new play, Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, will be the final story about the world-famous wizard.
This week, Ukraine commemorated the 75th anniversary of the Babinyar massacres. During World War II, this ravine was on the outskirts of Kyiv. It became a Nazi killing field during the German occupation. On the 29th to 30th of September 1941, almost 34,000 Jewish children, women and men were marched there and executed in what was to become one of the first mass exterminations of Jews. During the Soviet era, this was largely silenced. This year, massive commemorations were organized by the Ukrainian state and various organizations, including the Ukrainian Jewish Encounter. Ukraine Calling listeners will remember that last week we reported that many events were planned, including official commemorations at the site, a scholarly conference, a remembrance concert, and much more. Israeli President Reuven Rivlin traveled to Ukraine for the occasion, as did German President Joachim Gauck. We'll bring you an in-depth interview about this with Yale professor Timothy Snyder later in the show. This week, Ukraine also made international headlines when the Dutch-led joint investigation team held a news conference about the MH17 flight that was shot down over Donetsk over 2 years ago on the 17th of July 2014. The chief Dutch police investigator announced that they had concluded that, quote, Flight MH17 was downed by a Buk missile of the series 9M83 that came from the territory of the Russian Federation, unquote. Russia disputed the findings. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov repeated Russia's familiar line, "We've been ruling out the fact that any Russian weapons were shipped to Ukraine, any Russian army members or any Russian troops were inside Ukraine," he said, "and we're still ruling out that possibility." Ukraine's President Poroshenko welcomed the findings, saying, "We have solid proof of who is to blame for this dreadful crime." Over the past week, despite the relative calm at the front in the war zone, 2 Ukrainian soldiers were killed and 15 were injured. This week, 8 more judges were removed from their positions by President Poroshenko. Natalia Volodkina from Kyiv and Taisa Matyash from Odessa were dismissed for violating their oath. According to news reports, 6 other judges were fired in Donetsk, Vinnytsia, Kyiv, and Sevastopol. And meanwhile, in Russia, Russia's Supreme Court upheld the ban on the Crimean Tatar Majlis this week. The ban was imposed a year and a half ago when the Majlis, the Crimean Tatar executive representative body, was labeled an extremist organization. Ukraine Calling listeners will remember that a few weeks ago, we reported on the detention of Ilmi Umerov, deputy chairman of the Majlis, who chose to remain in Russian-occupied Crimea. He was locked up in a psychiatric hospital for weeks to protest against the Russian court decision and support the Majlis people gathered in Kyiv's central square, the Maidan, on Wednesday the 28th of September. And in the cultural sphere, J.K. Rowling's latest work, the 2-act play Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, is now available in Ukraine. The Ukrainian translation has just become available ahead of any Russian or Polish ones, thanks to the efforts of Ivan Malkovich, who created and runs a children's publishing house. He has been publishing Rowling's work for years. What a somber week, a week of remembrance. I remember as a young boy, my mother telling me about seeing Jews being marched off in columns to execution in a place we now know was called Babinyar. And walking over to this studio to record this discussion, I was very pleased to see that 75 years later, the flag of Israel was flying alongside the Ukrainian flag along the Khreshchatyk, presumably to welcome the visiting Israeli president here for the commemorative events associated with the 75th anniversary of the Babin Yar executions and tragedy. Well, to discuss the significance and meaning of all of that and where we are today with understanding what happened and what it means for all of us, Ukrainians, Jews, Poles, human beings generally, I'm very honored to have in the studio with me a leading authority on this part of the world, a figure, a writer who has done more than any other in recent years to jolt our memories and to refresh our memories, but to force us to think differently about what has happened in what he termed the bloodlands of Europe. And of course, you will guess from that title that I'm talking about none other than Timothy Snyder, professor at Yale University and a leading intellectual figure of our time now. Professor, I'm very happy to welcome you today, and let us begin by focusing on Babin Yar itself. You gave a brilliant presentation yesterday in which you so lucidly talked about such complex and tragic events. I'd be very happy if you shared with us your main thoughts, that your main thesis that you presented. And let's begin by asking you, from today's point of view, what do we know about what actually happened at Babin Yar?
We know a great deal, although we're going to continue to learn more. And it's very important as we remember Babi Yar, as we commemorate Babi Yar, as Ukrainians think about what kind of museum, how they want to institutionalize the memory of Babi Yar, that we remember that historians are still at work, Ukrainian historians, Western historians, to figure out some of the basic facts. But we know the following. We know that on the 29th and 30th of September 1941, 33,771 Jewish children, women, and men were marched from Kiev to a meeting point from which, on one day or the next, they were shot either kneeling over the ravine at Babi Yar or lying on top of people who had already been killed. We know that the killing, the shooting, was carried out by a so-called Sonderkommando of an Einsatzgruppe, a special group led by the SS, assisted by two battalions of German police, and also assisted by some local inhabitants of Kiev and perhaps some other Ukrainians as well. This we know, and this event, horrible and significant as it was in a way only the beginning of a larger event, which is the mass killing, the Holocaust of the Jews of the occupied Soviet Union.
And I wanted to ask you, then, what is the significance, what is the broader meaning of Babin Yar for the Holocaust, for our understanding of the Holocaust?
Mm-hmm. It's very appropriate that Jews who come from Eastern Europe would remember Babi Yar as a symbol. It's very appropriate that scholars of the Holocaust turn their attention to Babi Yar as well, because Babi Yar demonstrates how the Holocaust could be carried out. It was at this moment, the summer of 1941, that the Germans realized that this thing that Hitler and others had called the final solution could become the horrible reality that we now remember as the Holocaust. This method that was carried out at Babi Yar, the cooperation of German institutions, the mass shooting in the open air, the increasing collaboration of local people, this was the method which was then applied all over the occupied Soviet Union, not just in Ukraine, Belarus, the Baltic states, Western Russia. Everywhere the Germans went, killings, not on this scale, this was the largest, but killings of this kind were carried out as the German armies moved to the east. And even as they came back to the west, as in Kerch, for example, there were further mass killings. In this way, the Germans learned that a Holocaust was possible. In this way, more than 2 million human beings lost their lives. And in this way, we also learn what human beings are capable of. When we think of Auschwitz, of later methods of killing, we often separate ourselves from the horrible reality of our own capabilities by metaphors like of death factories or of machines. Whereas Babi Yar and the way the Holocaust begins teaches us that getting large numbers of people to kill even larger numbers of people is unfortunately not as difficult as we might think.
But at the end of the day, how could it happen? How could it happen a few days after the Germans marched in to be able to round up tens of thousands of people and just shoot them?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, a part of the answer, unfortunately, is the part I've already given, namely that it doesn't actually take much to turn a human being into a killer. Unfortunately, the question is really the opposite. How do we preserve the institutions, the ways of life, the laws, the habits that prevent us from doing things like this? But to answer your question, I think most historians would emphasize three factors. The first is an idea, a big idea, an ideology, a worldview in which the Jews have a specific and central place. In Hitler's worldview, it is the Jews who are responsible for all evil, because it is the Jews who prevent the Germans from always being victorious, from taking what they want, which is the second idea. The second idea is Lebensraum, empire, colonies, the notion that Germans as a superior race deserve to conquer Eastern Europe, and in particular need to control the fertile soil of Ukraine. And without that idea, without the idea of a racial war for Ukraine, without the quest for Lebensraum, German forces don't come into Kiev in the first place. So that's another very important component of what happens. And the third idea is lawlessness, statelessness, the separation of Jews and everyone else from the normal patterns of daily life by the alteration, the mutation, or even the destruction of the rule of law and of states themselves. The Germans, wherever they went, created a kind of legal or political chaos. We stereotype the Germans as being orderly, but in fact, the German march into Eastern Europe through Austria, Czechoslovakia, Poland, and finally the Soviet Union was the conscious generation of chaos, of lawlessness, of statelessness, which allowed people to do things they wouldn't have done in other situations. Those are the three big factors.
We recall that for many decades, Babin Yar is a place where so many Jews and others, including Ukrainians and gypsies and invalids, were killed, that this factor was hushed up. This was presented by the Soviet authorities as simply a place where many Soviet citizens had been killed. And I was also struck by the fact yesterday that a renowned German historian said, well, you know, we didn't really know that much until recently about Babin Yar itself. We knew about the Holocaust. How would you explain these phenomena, and how have they affected our remembrance of what happened there?
The history of the Holocaust shows that that the history is hard work. Even the events which seem to screamingly demand our attention can be rather easily forgotten or altered in such a way that they seem less significant. In the case of Babi Yar and the Holocaust in the East, there's several kinds of forgetfulness. There is the forgetfulness of the Nazi perpetrators who, in order to hide their tracks, forced Soviet prisoners of war in 1943 to cover the site. There is the forgetfulness of the Soviets themselves who, wanting to define German aggression as fascism against communism, ignored the specific hostility of the Nazis against the Jews. There is the forgetfulness of some nationalists in Ukraine and elsewhere who at the time said, in effect, the Jews deserved this, and therefore there's no reason for us to remember it because no harm has really been done. And then finally, there's the forgetfulness of the West, the model of the Holocaust that we generated during the Cold War in the West, according to which the Holocaust was mainly about West European Jews or German Jews, and it was something which mainly happened after deportation in trains to some distant gas chamber, which meant that our metaphors of the Holocaust involved things like confusion, people being sent to places they didn't know, and then at the end there was a kind of mechanized form of death. Whereas in fact, half of the Holocaust happened in a very different way in the places where Jews lived as well as died, Poland, the Baltics, the Soviet Union, face to face. And this never really reached Western consciousness for a couple of reasons. The first is that we, in order to have Holocaust memory, you need survivors, And you need survivors in places like France and Italy, where they can write, where Western Europeans can read them. And the second is that even German memory of the Holocaust, impressive as it is, contains a minimization. Germans associate the Holocaust with Auschwitz, but in doing that, they protect themselves from the basic reality that long before Auschwitz, tens of thousands of Germans were killing millions of people as hundreds of thousands of other Germans looked on. In other words, German society knew all about the Holocaust even before there was Auschwitz. So when Germans accept Auschwitz, which of course they should, they have been displacing the other part of the Holocaust. And so it was really, our German colleague was right, it was really only after 1989 that this half of the Holocaust began to impose itself on German memory. And of course, it forces Germans to ask other questions, because the main question in the Cold War was, how could this have happened without our knowing, which is a false question. The real question is, how could people like us do things like this?
Right. And how should we remember Babyn Yar today? The way that Ukrainian Jewish encounter and the state of Ukraine today are trying to commemorate it 75 years on. Is this a good start? Is it belated? Is enough being done at this stage to remember in a dignified way, in a way that has lessons for all of us at this stage?
Well, I mean, I should say as an outsider that, and as a historian, that I'm always impressed if politicians, giving all of the demands on their time and all of the pressing concerns, especially in a place like Ukraine, can find a time and a place, a moment of dignity to recall an event like this. It seems to me to be a very good thing that the state of Ukraine is taking this week and devoting so much attention to these events. Now, how should this be done? I offer what I think, but very modestly, And as a proposition, because the business of memory is a business of societies, of national societies, and they have to work things out. But as I see it, there are three levels to this. There is the Holocaust as a general problem, the problem of how humans behave. And this is universal. It's as relevant for you and for me as it is for Ukrainians in Kyiv. Then there's the problem of the Holocaust in the Soviet Union, which was what we've been discussing today. The history of the Holocaust in Belarus, Ukraine, Russia is very much the same. So trying to explain why local people took part in shooting, for example, is just as relevant for Russians and for Belarusians and for Lithuanians, Latvians, Estonians, as it is for Ukrainians, because that's how the Holocaust happened here. That said, and this is the third level, we can't expect that Russians and Lithuanians and Ukrainians will carry out remembrance together. Remembrance will be done nationally. And so it seems to me that the history you share might be universal, or it might be broader than your own nation, but how you choose to remember is characteristic of your nation, or better yet, how you choose to remember is how you choose to build your nation. So it's very much my sense that if Ukrainians wish to build a political nation with a future, they have to be able to also look reflectively upon the past, not to take responsibility for everything, because that would be too much, but to find a way to take responsibility for something. Because if there's zero responsibility, there's also zero nation.
And of course, we're not at that stage in historic development, at least in Europe, where we're trying to build nation states anymore.
It's an excellent point. I mean, a political nation means the ability to converse within a political society where not everyone has the same cultural origins, or maybe even the same language, right? Political nation means the ability to converse. And the ability to converse can only arise through the ability to converse about the past. If we have no ability to get over our own position with past events, then we have no ability to get beyond political narcissism in the present. So for me, the process of creating the political nation is always a historical process as well. It always involves the ability to be reflective about the people you identify with in the past and to see other points of view in the past. If you can't do that, if you can't create a conversation about the past, it's going to be very hard to do it in the present.
It's obviously a very interesting set of questions that you raise there, because on the one hand, Ukrainians need to have an inclusive view of their past with their neighbors who shared their territory and who suffered and who were made to suffer on this territory. And on the other hand, in a parallel process, as your books indicate, there is a need for a Western audience to understand more globally the interdependence or interconnectedness of these tragedies and atrocities, and in terms of what they mean for the human psyche and human development. So I think that we are all very grateful for your books, because you've made us all think yet again, but you've also made those who perhaps felt they already had a clear enough understanding of what had happened to also look again.
Thank you.
Where do you see Ukraine in the scheme of things? You're a historian not just of the 30s and 40s and these tragic times, but you're also somebody that's looking at positive developments and the positive moves that are being made. Obviously, you're interested in Poland, for example, but you're interested in Europe more broadly. Where would you place Ukraine in the scheme of things now, before and after Maidan?
Mm-hmm. I think the fate of Ukraine, and this goes back to your previous comment as well about what Westerners need to understand. I think the fate of Ukraine was central in the entire history of the 20th century, and it's also central to the history of the 21st, at least in the West. Ukraine was at the center of the rivalry between two different kinds of empires: the National Socialist attempt to conquer Ukraine for its own purposes, but also the Soviet attempt to exploit Ukrainian territory to build what Stalin understood as socialism. Ukraine was right in the middle, and that's why so many people died in Ukraine. That's why Ukraine was the most dangerous place in the world between 1933 and 1945. And the nature of the political competition today is different, happily, from what it was in the 1930s and 1940s. But nevertheless, Ukraine is also in the center. After the end of empire, what we have in Europe is an age of integration, where European nation states, rather than seeking to dominate peoples around the world, have built a construction. That construction is called the European Union. It's awkward, it's imperfect, it's sometimes funny, but it's the largest zone of peace and prosperity in the world. It has a bigger economy than China. It has a bigger economy than the United States. It has a better developed set of social welfare regimes than anywhere else. It's among the list of the least corrupt countries. Most of them are members of the European Union, and so on and so forth. In other words, it's a success. It's a non-imperial success. Ukraine, once again, is at the edge. If the European model is going to continue, it will continue because it continues to be attractive. If the Ukrainian state is going to succeed, it's going to succeed because it joins the European Union at some point. In the meantime, the crucial question is the state. Can the West help Ukrainians to build a state, a rule of law state that functions? If so, that state will eventually move closer to Europe. And likewise, as we look even further down the line, Ukraine is basically the only hope for Russia. I mean, that is to say, if one doesn't think the current Russian model of development is ideal, there have to be successes in the post-Soviet sphere which show that people from here can also follow the rule of law. So it's in a way terrifically unfair for Ukrainians that they're in the center of things, but they are. That's just the way it is.
As Poland was for many decades or centuries.
And as some people in Poland now seem to be longing to return to that state. But yes, exactly.
And, finally, we have to round up. I just wanted not only to pay you another compliment and to thank you for all the writing that you've done that has not simply set the record straight, but as I've tried to indicate, has made people look afresh, rethink their schemes, their view of things, their understanding of things. I've been struck by the fact that the younger people here seem to almost treat you as a star. When they hear Timothy Snyder, they want your autographs, they want to be photographed with you. It's clear that you, as a writer, as an academic, as a historian, you've really made a splash in this part of the world, not to mention in the West. And so I'd like to thank you once again and to wish you success and perseverance in your work, because I'm sure that you've made a lot of friends, but you've also made enemies along the way.
I've made the right kinds of friends, and that's the important part. And I'm very happy to have the friends that I have among the generation of Ukrainians that's come of age in the 21st century, because it's a fantastically interesting generation, and I think it's going to be a transformative generation.
Thank you, Professor Snyder.
My pleasure.
This week's song is called Pustelya, which means desert. It's a new song by the Kyiv band Oleum. Among other phrases, the lyrics include, I've had it with this war, and the desert will end and the war will end.
Стінка з циферблатом грає, грає в час. Маємо, що маємо, і віримо, що все гаразд. Голом в пісок хто, а хто на бій зі злом? Хто рахує статки, а хто чита псалом? Тим часом бімбо, години бімбо, бімбо, бо.
Looking forward, we will continue to watch all the stories in Ukraine. Tune in next weekend for a new episode of Ukraine Calling. If you have any suggestions or comments, please write to the show at ukrainecalling@hromadskeradio.org. I'm Bohdan Nahailo in Kyiv, and thanks so much for listening.